Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio and the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Elke Duur. She's a filmmaker, author, visual and oral storyteller, fiber artist, photographer, workshop presenter, teacher, and the founder of the nonprofit Web of Life Foundation, WOLF. Elke is the recipient of numerous grants and film awards. She loves to debunk myths and preconceived notions about our animals and natural world and revolutionize the way we see and experience nature. So, I guess to start, can you kind of characterize how you perceive the culture as people in general as being taught to perceive nature, and then move from there to how you and many others perceive nature?
Thank you for having me, Derek, and thanks for this question. I feel that our mainstream culture sees nature as separate from us, as something that we are maybe subjugating, we are using, that's here for us and our needs, but intrinsically that doesn't have its own need. For me, it's different. I am part of nature. I actually just did a film about this. It's called I Am Nature, Your Human Nature. Nature in human form, because I've seen for a long time that we use nature. We go out there and we take what we need and we feel better for a little bit and then we go back to get more. And there's even a film out called Nature, the New Prozac. And when I first saw that, I thought, wow, now we've really commoditized nature even more. Now she is like an antidepressant that we're using when we're not feeling good. But how does nature feel? What does nature need from us? I myself feel that I am the outside earth. I am nature in Elke form, basically. I am human nature. I'm just a part of it all. I'm not the pinnacle of it all or on top of it all. I'm a part of this. And I'm very aware of it. And what we do to nature, basically, we do to ourselves. Because our bodies even are microcosm of the macrocosm that we have. So, for example, we have veins as much as the earth has rivers and streams. And, our blood vessels are like the waterways of this earth. So as within, so without. And I feel what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. And what we do to ourselves, we do to the earth. There's really no separation. And once we get to that point of realizing that, life takes on a whole new direction. For me, at least, it was like that, even though I was never really separate from Earth. But when I really consciously realized who I am and what my role is on this planet, life took on a whole different turn. And, and I still feel that way to this day. Every day I wake up and I'm here on this planet, still here and breathing. I feel it is a real gift and I am not separate from the bigger whole.
So two questions. One of them is, you talked about a fundamental, a sort of a shift that happened when you realized that. So either A, can you talk about that shift, or B, can you give us or how did that shift take place? Were there specific interactions with specific non-humans or specific places?
Yes, one story comes to mind. There's many, but one story comes to mind. When I got my first video camera, I went to Yellowstone National Park the next day, and I tried it out. And I went up to this lake, and I saw that there was another camera person there who was filming and was standing behind his camera. And I went to talk to this person, and he said that there were otters in the area, but to not really get my hopes up high to be able to see them. So I got really excited, and I said, oh, there's otters here. I've never seen an otter in person. I've only heard about them, and I've always wanted to meet them. So where do I find them? And he's like, oh, don't get your hopes up. There won't be any otters. I've been here for a long time looking for them and they're not coming out. And, there really is no point in doing this. So I tried to make small talk with this person, but it didn't go anywhere. So I just sat down at the lake, and I was really excited. I was happy to be there. I was happy at the prospect of maybe seeing or hearing some otters. And I was just in tune with everything else and around me. And I was part of everything else. I wasn't separate. So when that person left, I sat down and I zoomed in my camera and I told the otters, wherever they might be, he is gone. You can come out now. And 2 seconds later, I had to zoom out my camera because all I saw was fur, because they came out of the lake right in front of me. And I had no idea where they might exit or where they might be, but they were right there. And I realized that when we see nature or other beings, other animals, because I consider us the human animal, as separate from us, that's when they become an object and we become above them. We become their observers. But I became one with everything, and so the animals were fearless. They felt that. And I had the most amazing period filming them for hours and hours, playing and doing everything that otters might do. And it was so amazing. We were one. It felt like I wasn't the spectator. I wasn't the camera operator. I was just part of everything else. And it was really beautiful. And I will never forget that. And since then, there have been many incidents like that. But that really brought the point home for me again that we're all one. It's all connected. And I'm not on top of anything or any system, that I'm just a part of it. And I thoroughly enjoyed that experience.
So what are a couple other examples of when that's happened?
Also, I've been making a film about the last Mexican gray wolves in New Mexico and in Arizona. And they're the most endangered land mammal in North America. There's not that many left. And they're the smallest subspecies of the gray wolf. I was camped out one day, and I don't bait the animals, and I don't go after them, and I don't track them, and I don't feed them. Many people that are camera operators or photographers do that for a better view of them or to get better footage. But I never do that because it doesn't feel right. It feels like I am jeopardizing them by feeding them. And next time I'm gone, somebody else comes along and does, and they go to that person and get shot because they're too close to that person. So ethically, I do not like this kind of behavior. So I just sat there and I communicate with the animals. I let them know who I am, what my intentions are. And so that's what I did that day. I put up my tent. I sat there and I communicated who I was and what my intentions were and why I was there. And I was asking for their collaboration and to possibly show themselves to me so I could take some footage and put that in the film. And as I was sitting there, it was really interesting. I also had that feeling of being one with everything, not above it, not beneath it, not next to it, but I was one with everything. And it sounds very cliche, but that's really how it felt. And I got up and I went to the car and I took out my camping gear and I went to look for a place where I was going to put up my tent where I had been before and where I had felt that the animals were in the area. So as I was putting up my tent, I had that feeling again, oh, they're here. They've just been here. That's really great. I might see them. And I went back to the car and I stood at the hatchback and I was taking out some more equipment when I felt it again, that there was a presence, and I turned around slowly and there were four wolves looking at me, checking me out. And I felt the like they were assessing if I was worthy of making a documentary about them. And we looked at each other, and I felt this sense of connection again and oneness. And I silently communicated that who I was, what was going on, what my intentions were. And we looked each other in the eye, and there was a mutual understanding of, yes, this is who we are, and we have both benevolent to each other, and all five of us, actually. And there's no sense of having to be afraid or anything, and that we would be doing this as a co-production, that the wolves would be helping me, not even helping me, but working with me on this documentary.
How do you feel these communications primarily take place?
There's different ways. It's nonverbal because they don't understand English. It's mostly with feelings and with pictures in the mind. Sometimes it's also an inner knowing or hearing a message. But for me, it's mostly I get a picture, a very clear picture, and I get a knowing in my heart. And that's also how I put my questions to them out. So basically, it's like I play a movie of let's say, my benevolence and why I'm here in my head with pictures and also in my heart, and convey that to the animals. It's kind of like a telepathic communication, and they're doing a lot of research on that right now to explain how it really happens. But it's kind of like when the phone rings and you know who it is that's calling you, or even before the phone rings, you know that you're getting a call from somebody and who is calling you. So it's the same type of knowing. When I felt them behind me, it was a different feeling than I'd ever had when people were standing behind me, for example. It was totally different. My hair was standing up on my body, because I got goosebumps, because it was this feeling of total wildness, of like some instinctual being right behind me. And I knew that they were there before I even turned around. And when I turned around, lo and behold, they were standing there. So there's different ways to communicate, and we all do that. And we all have been doing that since childhood. It's our birthright. It's not something that we can really learn. It's more like something that we can unearth and reaffirm again, because we have been doing it as children, but then we have been told, no, it's not possible, and you're a dreamer, do something that that makes sense with your life. The animal communication, or inner species communication, as I call it, that's not really real, and you can't make a living with that. So all these things have been put into our heads with the so-called education that's prevalent in our society, in our Western society. So we sort of put it away. But now I find that when I travel and do presentations and film presentations, for example, a lot of young people come to me, and they often give up their recess or their lunchtime to talk to me and say, I talk to the animals as well, but my parents say it's not possible, or I've always done this my whole life. And so it's just a matter often of reaffirming that old skill in us, that old ability that's ancient, because our ancestors of old were able to do that as well. But we have let it atrophy a little bit. So now it's coming back, and I'm meeting a lot of, especially young people, who are wonderful communicators.
When I was in the run-up to me writing the book that became A Language Older Than Words, the first version of that book was supposed to be about interspecies communication. And one of the things and I started asking a lot of people if they had had examples of interspecies communication, and a lot of people had, And it was all just like you said, that they would sort of whisper it to me, and they would say, I've never told this story in public. So what got me really excited then was the dissonance between public and private discourse about it. If you ask a lot of people if they've ever had any sort of significant conversation with a non-human, they'll tell you about their dogs or their cats, or they'll tell you about these times in their life that were really moving to them. And then if you ask them, have you told that story in public? Almost every time they'll say no.
Yes.
Because everybody will make fun of them.
Yes, correct. Yeah, that's what I'm still getting as well. But if we all knew how many of us have had these experiences, then we wouldn't be so shy about it anymore. So part of my job is really to bring that out in people and to make it more normal in the public eye, basically, because it's such a wonderful ability that's been given to us. And why let it atrophy? Because we don't have to handle animals and trap them and sedate them and put a collar on them to get data from them. We can just communicate with them and observe them and be with them and get the same data, or maybe even more accurate data, I'm guessing. So by normalizing it more, I feel like there's a gift that's coming back to us that will make our life a lot more rich than it has been, because we have been so disconnected. And once we admit to ourselves that this is possible, then life becomes so much more multidimensional than we could ever imagine, and so much richer.
Two things. One of them is, so many indigenous people have said to me that the biggest difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that Western society is based on perceiving the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And indigenous perspectives are that the world is composed of other beings whose lives are as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me, other beings who have their own unique intelligences. And I see bears every day. I see them all the time. And different bears have completely different personalities, and they have different preferences, and some are shy and some are gregarious, and some, it's true with dogs, it's true with everybody. And can you tell any stories about different personalities or different personalities between different species too?
Yeah. The last 6 years I've been, dividing my time between Montana and New Mexico and anywhere else in between. And last year I spent 8 months in a tent on the ground in these areas just to be with the animals, because it's very important to me for them to have a person who comes to them and says, what do you need? Who are you? What would you like to share? Instead of them always having to flee from us in terror because we're such a threat to them, because we're always armed, at least with bear spray, if not with other weapons, and we often use those weapons. And so I spend a lot of time with the animals, and I do see distinct personalities and in them, and also maybe even different jobs that they're doing within the whole ecosystem, and even within a family structure. Let's say the wolves, some of them, like the mother and the father of a family, are often the breadwinners that go out and get the deer or the elk and teach the others to hunt as well. Whereas there's also like babies sitters that stay with the yearlings or the youngsters and protect them. So there's distinct personalities. And I remember from the wolves, these babysitters have to contend with a lot of mischief from the little ones. And I remember one day, one little one was especially mischievous and was tucking at the ear of the babysitter, I call the other wolf that was there with them, taking care of them, and biting them in the ear and the nose and scratching and doing all kinds of stuff until the adult wolf had enough of it, put his paw on the tail of the little one, and when he wanted to run, he couldn't. And when he had enough momentum, he let go of the tail, and the little one was tumbling down, tumbling down the hill. It was just so cute to see that they have a sense of humor, that they play, especially with the otters. I saw a lot of that. Again, there's probably different roles that they take within the family. But there were so many different personalities, and I would say there's individuals that are more shy than others, bolder ones, and also more curious ones. Because I remember also this one wolf family came by and showed me their offspring. They had 7 puppies at that time, the sad thing is, half of them died during the first year, but they still had 7 of their original litter, and they were all different. They were all different in terms of size and what they looked like and how bold they were or how shy they were or how they stayed with the mother or how they ventured out. And I could almost tell then, from looking at certain individuals, that they would be the ones maybe leaving the family and looking for maiden territory. So yes, I've seen a lot of that. And then also in terms of different species, I would say, for example, the otters are very playful ones and they never attack any other species, maybe to defend themselves or to fish. That's when they get the fish. But other than that, they're very gentle and playful as a whole species. That's how I have seen them. Whereas other species, maybe like the bison, I also did a documentary about the last wild bison in the Northern Hemisphere and migrated with them for 4 years. You know, they come across as very powerful. They're also playful. They're calves, for the sheer joy of it, they are just running around and kicking and doing all kinds of antics just for the sheer joy of being alive. And I've seen that in so many species, if not all of them, that there's a certain playfulness. So yes, there are distinct personalities, I would say.
So what do you think the dominant worldview of perceiving them as not sentient beings is doing to, most importantly, the planet, and secondarily to us?
Well, since we are part of it all, it's also hurting us, because it's almost, you know, it's the same with us. We are sentient beings, but we are not using so many of our abilities are dormant. And so it's the same with us. We're kind of in a dormant state almost, and that's really hurting the planet, because as soon as we see what's really going on and get out of our little convenient way of seeing life as to be harvested or to be consumed, we will see that everything is sentient, and that we're hurting ourselves by hurting others. And especially the way we do the factory farming, or we do the so-called hunting, or we do even agriculture is a big point too as well, because we don't ascribe anything else to our plant food than being food and being dead, basically. But even plants are alive, and they don't want to be in rows and in monocultures, and they don't want to be sprayed. And they are so intricate and so evolved. I just read that flowers, when they sense bees or to attract bees, they can hear them. And then they send out even more, what would you call it, aroma to attract these bees to be pollinated. So even a plant that we would look at as really basic is very, very complicated and intricate. And I also just recently heard that they did research that plants scream basically on a frequency that we don't hear when there's danger or when they are being eaten or cut down. So even though we don't hear any of that and we don't sense it because we have sort of shut down and we are so dormant in our sensory perception these days, and even I would go as far as to say as sedated often, it exists. And we are hurting ourselves because we are destroying our very home, our very beautiful earth. And yes, we need to eat. Yes, we need to live somewhere, but it all can be done differently. We don't have to clear cut everything. We can take it. I know of a certain logging company. They are very mindful in the way they log, and they get 10 times more out of every tree as other companies who are just using trees as if there's no tomorrow. So we can do this in a mindful way. It's not like we have to shut ourselves in a cave or not eat or not do anything. No, it's just how we do it. And there's so many different ways of doing this life on earth that I'm very excited about that are now coming out that are much more mindful and sustainable, even though this word has been overused. But the bottom line is that we are starting to think of the earth and our home as our home and a living being, a sentient being altogether. And that means there are certain things we can't do anymore because they're hurtful to the whole system that we are part of. So I'm very excited about these new developments, and I'm very hopeful for the future.
So if somebody's listening to this interview and they live in an apartment in suburban Atlanta, Georgia, or if they live out in the wilds in Appalachia somewhere, what can they do? How did somebody start to open up in this way if you're not a child and it has been trained out of you and you're now 27 or 34 or 47? What should they do to start changing their perspective?
Really go out there, no matter where we are. Actually, I've been told that there's more diversity now in the cities in terms of pollinators, because often it doesn't get sprayed there. So, because there's a high human density. So just get out and reacquaint yourself with that child that you were a long time ago. And I was really looking at every bug, turning over every rock, and remember who you were back then, because it's still in you. And really find that joy again. You know, it doesn't have to be the wild. It doesn't have to be, you know, a huge park or whatever. It can be a flower growing out of a crack in the asphalt that's really getting your attention. Just really pay attention to your surroundings and where you live and who else lives there. It could be a bear, it could be a bug, it could be a falcon, whatever is around you. Just look and see who else is there with you in your ecosystem that you are living in, and see what their role is. And it will instill a lot of joy in you. I've seen that in many people when we find that again, because it's a lot of enthusiasm that comes along with being in nature and observing nature. And then from there on out, it'll be very easy to find a way to be of service to those creatures. And I'm always saying that, you know, because people say, oh, you work with the charismatic ones like the bears and the wolves. But it's not true. I love them all. And I work with all of them because they're all very, very important. A bee is just as important as a wolf because most of our food gets pollinated by pollinators and bees. So they're all important. And be it hummingbirds, be it bees, you will find a way to be of service to them and to make sure that they can exist, and that they can thrive in your ecosystem where you're living. And it doesn't really matter where it is. We often think, oh, we have to go to the wild. We have to go to the wilderness. We have to build a house in the wilderness. Well, that often is worse because then we plop down some building on the calving ground of the elk or we scare away the bear that used to live there because we have dogs that chase after them. So it's not necessarily better to be in the wilderness. It depends, you know, it depends on our level of awareness and unconsciousness. Because the more conscious we are about our neighbors and what they need, the better of a neighbor we will be to them.
So somebody in their apartment goes into the bathroom and they're going to take a shower, and they see that in the upper left corner of the shower, there's a little spider with a web. Mm. So take the scenario from there. I mean, how normally they may have either killed the spider or not have noticed it, but now having noticed it, what remember you're going against several thousand years of training.
Yes.
Personally, you know, decades of training. So okay, so I see a spider in the corner of my shower. What am I supposed to do now?
Yeah, that's the thing. The more we wake up, the less we can do things that we've always done, like squish the spider and proceed to take a shower. Once we are aware of how important all the other players in the ecosystem are, we can't do these things anymore because it doesn't feel right anymore. So I would say it depends on the human and where they are at the moment. If there's still fear of spiders instilled in them, because that's very common, because that's what we've been told forever, how dangerous spiders are, as opposed to many Native American stories where spiders are revered because they were weaving together the earth, and we learned from them how to weave and how to basically be very still and wait for our food to come to us, which is very different from this fearful way of seeing them. Now it depends on us. Can we do this? Can we maybe get a glass and a piece of paper and gently take the spider out? And if it's not winter, or can we say, okay, I can still take a shower. It's in the upper corner and I'm on the other end. You know, I can maybe leave the spider here until it gets warmer and I can take the spider out. Even though I've been told too that spiders who were raised basically or who hatched in the house are not that well suited for the outside, but I'm still taking the spiders out when I can. So there's something about our consciousness. What is it telling us? And also, what's really being asked of us right now is to have some courage, to not always go with the grain, to go against it sometimes and swim against the current and go with what we ourselves know to be true in our hearts. And that's very important right now, that we become more courageous and talk about these things, talk about communication with animals and other species, talk about taking the spiders out of the house, talk about not swatting every mosquito, but maybe using some repellent oil on our skin or something. There's so many other ways. You know, we've been taught to kill. And I remember that as a child too. I grew up in Germany post-World War II, and there was absolutely no consciousness about animals. It was all about survival and building the country back up. So when there was talk about there maybe being rabies in a preemptive strike, they were killing all the foxes with poisons, guns and traps and noxious fumes. And I remember I was a little child and I knew the foxes because after school I was always sitting with them in front of the den, and they would show me their litter, they would show me their cubs, and I knew them. I wasn't touching them or whatever, but we lived our lives together. And I remember occupying the fox dens as a child and saying, "No, over my dead body, will you kill my foxes?" Of course, they carried me away, or they waited till I fell asleep or something, and they did what they wanted anyways. But I stood up for them right then and there already. And I think it's very important to have the courage these days to stand up for what we love and what we know to be true.
And I think that's really important, the notion of seeing non-human neighbors as your neighbors and friends, as opposed to seeing them as either pests or background, or seeing them as at best some sort of exotic being that shows up and you can get all excited to see them through the window, which is better than the others.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, it's also. Our disconnection, you know, to see them through the window. Yeah. Or to take pictures with them to be special.
And I keep thinking about how we evolved hearing all these other non-humans and seeing them. I read many years ago that if somebody was near a river in California, they would see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes.
Oh.
And I consider myself lucky to see a few bears every day. They're not grizzlies, they're black bears. And just how, you know, I think about this a lot, that we can all name various advertising jingles, or people of a certain age can still remember the theme song from Gilligan's Island, but how few of us, myself included, can name the same number of bird songs or can identify flowers or trees or any of our neighbors. We're living in a giant echo chamber where all we see is made by humans. And that's, I think that messes us up.
Yeah. When you talk about our neighbors, you know, we put the neighbors there. You know, we often take down whole ecosystems just to put in a lawn. Or we bring our ecosystem with us, you know, our dogs and cats, and they have the upper hand over any wild animal. If there's a mountain lion coming close, we have them removed, or we have the bear removed if they take an apple from the tree. So, yeah, in favor of those that those life forms that we deem worthy. And this is a good point, because we live in this binary society, wolf or dog, wheat or vegetable, bison or cattle. And we have decided who's worth it and who isn't, and who needs to die, who can live and who needs to die, according to our preferences. If we can use the animal, sell the animal, wear the animal, eat the animal, then it's useful. And a wolf is useless because we can't do anything with the wolf. And what's worse, the wolf might take a sheep or a cow from our herd. So we are the ones who are deciding what can live and what needs to die. And that's also a very dangerous vantage point to come from. It'd be really good to look at what really thrives in nature. I just read yesterday there is a person in New Zealand, and they just let nature take over again in areas that were severely overgrazed by cattle, and it looks really beautiful now. Again, nature took over. In 30 years, it got rehabilitated. So nature knows best what grows and what should be there. And it would be great for us to take some time out of our hectic schedule. And I don't know why the schedule always has to be so hectic, because when I was with Grandma, her schedule definitely wasn't like that, even though she worked a lot too. But she always took the time to watch nature and to see what was growing naturally and what was thriving and how it was thriving. And she took great pleasure from that. And I think that would really benefit us to see who those neighbors are that are thriving and allowing them to thrive instead of insisting on removing them and putting somebody else there.
So we have about 4 or 5 minutes left, and I have two questions for you. One of them is, if most of us have this as children, how did you not lose it? And the second question is, if people are interested in your work, how can they find out more about it?
Thank you so much for these questions, because somebody else just asked me that. For some reason, I insisted on being myself and not losing these things, because everything else that was offered to me didn't make sense. And I just talked to my dad about that. I said, "Dad, what was the hardest thing about raising me?" And he said, "You just wouldn't take our advice on what to become and who to be. You just insisted on staying who you were." And now he said, "I see the value of that." But back then I thought, "You will never make it in this life, because you're so different and you're insisting on caring for all other life forms," which we thought was really silly and not possible. So I hung on to it, but also because I had a great grandmother who was a healer and completely connected. And she was with me the first 4 years of my life. And she always sit me in her lap and tell me stories or just be with me. And she also never caved in when society wanted her to take a different turn. She always stayed herself too, and I attribute that to her, that I had an easier time staying myself and not going a different route and then backtracking. And if somebody would like to get in touch with me, you can go to my website. I started the Web of Life Foundation. You find that under www.weboflifefoundation.net, and then also my personal website, www.elkedur.com, elkedurr.com. I do a lot of animal communication sessions with people and their pets, and also with people who would like to build a home in the wilderness and are curious about their neighbors that are there and wondering about the best place to put their home and how to best coexist with their wild neighbors that have been there long before they came. And you can also find my videos, my wolf film, and some other films like I Am Nature or My Happy People, A Message from the Earth on Vimeo under my name, Elke Duer on Vimeo. And again, it's E-L-K-E, which is elk with an E in the end, and last name D-U-E-R-R. That's how you can find me on Vimeo. And thank you so very much for your interest in my work. It's my dream come true. And all this has changed so much since I was a child. There's so much more interest in our neighbors now and the rest of the world, and so much more awareness coming.
Well, thank you for that. And we were going to end, except now I have another question.
Yes.
I'm going to tell, and this has to be really short for both of us.
Okay.
I'm going to tell a really cosmic story, and then I'm going to ask you to tell a really cosmic story.
Okay.
So my mom, there was one bear in particular that my mom especially had a tremendous relationship with. She could go out on the porch and the bear would show up, and this bear we called Mama, and my mom knew this bear for years, and eventually, the bear moved to another territory. And we didn't see her for years. We thought maybe she died. We didn't know. And then last year, my mom was dying of cancer. And about 2 weeks before my mom entered terminal delirium, so she's still functional at this point, Mama shows up and sits on the porch for about a week. And both of us, I mean, this was very, very moving. My mom said either she's coming to tell me I'm gonna get better, or she's coming to tell me goodbye. And I said, I think she's coming to tell you that everything is going to be okay no matter what. And anyway, so my mom had a very close, intimate relationship with this bear, and very good friends. And then when the bear somehow found out my mom was dying, the bear came back. So now it's your turn for a cosmic story.
I'll stay with the bear. I always have a bear song that I sing when I go into the wild and when I hike. And I was singing my bear song that day, so that the bears know who I am and can feel my spirit and can go away if they want or stay if they want. But anyways, I was singing my bear song and I was going around the corner, and this one particular bear had opted to stay there and take a risk. It was a male grizzly standing up on his hind legs eating berries. And it's the cutest thing and the coolest thing in the world, because they're eating these tiny little berries. And he was showing me his profile. He wasn't looking at me, because the bears know, you know, we feel like it's a sign of aggression if they look at us directly. So I saw this bear standing right in front of me eating berries and kind of glancing at me. And I said, from the bottom of my heart, unpremeditated, I said, oh, thank you. I love you. Thank you for being on the mountain. It's so important that you're here. The mountain is not the same without you. I love you. I love you. And the bear turned around and looked at me. And at that moment, there was a connection through our eyes, because we were looking at each other. And at that moment, we both threw overboard what our mothers had told us about each other. Run, run. And we gave it a chance. And I had this throwback to a long time ago when we were still connected with nature. And I looked at him and I said, bear, bear, that's what a bear is. And he looked at me and he felt like, woman, woman, that's what a true woman is. And we both got so excited that this was possible to make contact in a non-threatening, non-afraid way with all this love. And I felt love from the bear and I sent him love. And I turned around because I didn't want to take pictures or milk that situation. And I said goodbye to him and I kept on walking and he kept on eating. And to this day, I feel him thinking of me, that with all this hope for the future of the Bear Nation, that this humans that are benevolent towards them.
Well, thank you so much for all your work, and thank you for being on the program, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Elke Duhr. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.